Young, SEAL Team 5, stood up in the Zodiac boat, spun his HK-416 rifle over his back, and climbed up the pilot ladder that had been lowered by the crew of the San Fernando Chieftain. Just like the interdiction his platoon had made that uncovered the rocket parts from France, his boarding today would be bottom-up, meaning from the water. Also, as in that raid, this time his counterpart, Bones Hackworth of Bravo Team, would be hitting top-down, from a helo already on station an eighth of a mile off the bow and closing. This was not a typical sanctions enforcement. Normally, he and his mates spot-checked cargo containers or cargo holds, with no specific intelligence on where to look or what exactly they were looking for. But for today's interdiction, he had received specific intelligence about what he was looking for and where he could find it. From his understanding, the intel came from the Defense Intelligence Agency, although it had been filtered through channels and was delivered to him via sat phone contact with the intelligence officer of Team 5 in Seoul. The IO had directed him to open and inspect 4 45-foot high cube shipping containers. He even had the hold number and location on the boat for where to find them. There had been no information, oddly, on just what it was they were supposed to find inside the containers, but Ricks figured it didn't take much imagination to conclude he and his mates had hit this ship to grab another load of missile parts. The last time there had been resistance, and Ricks knew he couldn't count on things going any easier for this interdiction, but so far they'd seen no evidence that the crew was trying to hide anything or slow the SEALs down from taking a look for themselves. Weird. This seems too damn easy, he thought as he climbed onto the deck. But he kept his rifle up high, scanning for threats. But there was no resistance from the crew. Ricks and his men took the wheelhouse while Hackworth and his team went for the engine room. In 10 minutes, the entire 14-member crew was covered on the deck by 4 men, and the rest of the SEALs headed for cargo hold 2. The containers were there, just as the IO had said. The numbers on the doors matched the report. Greaser and Hendricks stepped forward and broke the seal on the first container. They opened the doors, and Ricks looked in with the flashlight on the end of his rifle. He scanned the beam up and down, and then left and right. Hendricks stood behind him, and the Dutch special warfare operator said exactly what Ricks was thinking. Bad intel, Chief. There was no nuclear material inside the container. No missile parts either. Instead, there were 3 huge round pieces of machinery lying on their sides that Ricks first thought were industrial-sized boilers. There were invoices in pouches on the side of each massive unit. Ricks lowered his weapon and used the light on the side of his helmet now, and he saw the invoice said exactly what the equipment was. Froth flotation tanks. Greaser looked over some writing on the side of the unit. It's mineral refining equipment. The chief turned away without replying, headed to the next container to break the seal there. 20 minutes later, Chief Rick stood at the fantail of the ship with his sat phone to his ear. Typhoon Actual to Typhoon Main. Typhoon Main, go ahead, Actual. No joy on the cargo. Understood, no joy. What did you find? It's not WMD equipment. A pause. Understood. What did you find, Actual? Ricks explained. He waited a long time for a response, and he was about to check to see if Maine had copied his last transmission, but then they replied. Typhoon Actual, listen up. These containers are going to be offloaded from the ship. You will stay on board until a transloader arrives from Seoul, ETA to follow. You will oversee the transloading, and then you will release the ship and the rest of the cargo. Ricks cocked his head. Roger that. Just to clarify, I understand we are to confiscate this mining equipment and hold the ship until we offload it? Typhoon Actual, Typhoon Main, roger. Ricks paused. Can we do that? Chief, as far as you are concerned, you have been told that material is WMD-related. Do you understand? Rick scratched the narrow portion of his neck between his body armor and the bottom of his helmet. Roger that, Typhoon Main. Actual out. Chief Ricks made his way back to his team in the cargo bay, where he found Greaser, Hendricks, and Hackworth. Echo Platoon was ready to hear the order to release the crew and disembark. Ricks said, "Listen up. If anybody asks, we just found ourselves some more WMD. Greaser turned to his chief. "Come again?" "Nuke parts." Hendricks said, "They look more like washing machines." "Fuck, Hendricks, I don't know. Maybe they use them to wash their ICBMs. I just know we are transloading this stuff to a ship heading over from South Korea." Hendricks said, "So, this is kind of like stealing, right? We are pirates now?" Ricks just shrugged. "I guess National Command knows what it's doing." Hendricks said, "Doesn't sound to me like POTUS knows what the hell he's doing. The North Koreans are assholes when we don't do anything to them. Stealing their shit might just send them over the edge." "Hendricks," Rick said, "I can't wait till you're president. You've already got it all figured out." "I can't be president, Chief. I was born in Holland." Ricks turned and headed for the main deck to let the rest of the platoon know the plan. He called back in a sarcastic tone, "Well, that sure is a pity, Hendricks." Chapter 55. Sam Driscoll was just 12 hours into his surveillance of Veronica Martell's apartment building when a black BMW i8 pulled up in front and parked on the street. It was well past nightfall, and a thunderstorm sent thick sheets of rain onto the street, so Sam couldn't make out the license plate from his vantage point. But he didn't need to. He knew the vehicle. He'd seen Edward Riley pulling into the parking lot under Sharp's Global Intelligence Partners more than once during his surveillance there, and he couldn't help but admire the man's choice in automobiles. Driscoll's job here had been to keep an eye out for any North Koreans watching over Martell. Ryan didn't know if they'd come after her, but now that she seemed to be on the outside of the operation to help them obtain intel for their rare metals refinery, he worried she'd end up like Hazelton. It seemed unlikely, but he didn't want to leave it to chance. Sam called Ryan, who answered quickly. "Hey, Sam, what's up?" "Wanted to let you know that Edward Riley just pulled up to Martell's apartment." "You sure it's him?" "Have you seen his car?" "No, what does he drive?" "Beamer, i8. "Nice. Not exactly covert, but nice. That coming from the guy who used to drive a canary yellow Hummer." "Touché. I wonder what he's doing there. I guess he's either going to give her another assignment or fire her. He's alone?" "Yep. I checked the street for followers. It's raining up here, but as far as I can tell, there are no sneaky North Koreans skulking around tonight." "Okay. Hey, by the way, you're getting some company."
"Who?"
"All of us. Clark has us all heading back up to NYC. We don't have anything else to do but keep an eye on Martell."
"I thought Sharps compromised the team in New York."
"You going to go mobile on the streets?"
"We think she's clear of North Korean surveillance, and we think the North Koreans were the ones who tipped off Sharps. We might be okay. Still, I have a feeling we won't be mobile very much. Most likely we'll all be hanging out at your place."
Sam said, "Awesome. 5 dudes in a one-bathroom studio apartment eating pizza all day."
"Just like college," Ryan said, and Sam just grunted.
Riley arrived during a thunderstorm. He wore jeans and a black sweater, and he came empty-handed other than his umbrella and his mobile phone. Veronica offered him tea, which he declined, so they sat on opposite chairs in her living room. She could tell from his demeanor there was a problem.
"What's happened?"
Riley leaned forward. "Last night our time, the United States Navy stopped the vessel delivering the froth flotation tanks to North Korea. They confiscated the material." Veronica did not reply. She was an intelligent woman. She assumed the Americans learned of the existence of the material from her download from Valley Floor.
and she also realized Riley needed someone to take the fall for what happened in Vegas. Just so you are aware, Duke is angry with you. He thinks you tipped off the Americans. The North Koreans are bloody furious as well. Martell rolled her eyes. That is completely absurd. Someone compromised the operation somehow. They broke into my hotel room knowing exactly what they were looking for. And you have no idea who might have done this, Riley asked. She stared him right in the eyes. She knew the truth, but she also knew how to lie. None whatsoever. Riley clearly wanted her on the defensive, but that wasn't her style. She said, "Perhaps you can help answer that question. You seem to be the one aware of the goings-on in my hotel room. You had me bugged. Did you have cameras on me? Is that it? Were you watching me change? Watching me sleep?" Riley shook his head. Now her attempt to put him on the back foot had failed. He was utterly unruffled. Associates on their own were there in the hotel. There was a listening device left in your room. Martell recoiled in surprise. Associates? Let's just say an interested party. You mean the North Koreans? Who? RGB? Riley conceded this with a nod. So you are working directly with the North Koreans now? Not with New World Metals? Riley did not deny it. Instead, he said, $12 trillion. Can you get your pretty little head around that number? That's the value of the mine. Yes. There is an opportunity here to get in on the ground floor of an incredible enterprise. By the very nature of the enterprise, only a few people will be involved. There won't be competition for the mineral wealth in North Korea. Instead, there will be one state-owned company extracting it inside the country, and one foreign firm handling everything else outside of the country. Riley held up a finger. One firm. New World Metals. That's just the name this week. The operation to get the equipment and personnel into the country. Oscar Robles has 100 companies under him, and he'll create 100 more. Shipping, materials, purchasing, marketing. Riley smiled now. External security. Each venture will grow and grow until they explode in value, because he is North Korea's man. Once North Korea gets their shipment of flotation cells, nothing will stop them. And how does any of that help you? You are Sharpsy's man. Riley waved away the comment. I'm my own man. Duke is hell-bent on keeping his involvement limited to the business intelligence field. I see the opportunities as being much broader, and I see Sharps's ideas as being too narrow in scope. North Korea will come around, to my understanding. Veronica nodded. So you went directly to the North Koreans and told them you were there for them. You would help them by going even further than Sharps. You'd help them kill people on the streets of America, if that's what they wanted. I am doing both entities a favor. All three, if you count Oscar Robles. Sharps gets plausible deniability. I work for Robles and General Ri, North Korea's intelligence chief, directly. And they cut you in. That's the idea. Veronica thought over everything that she was hearing. She didn't understand why Riley was telling her all this. She could turn right around and tell Sharps that his number two man was doing an end run around his clients. She'd been in this business long enough to trust her instincts, and for a brief moment she wondered if she might be in some danger here. Was Riley here to eliminate her as payback? For Vegas. She leaned forward a little, ready to leap for the kitchen and the knife rack if he made any sudden moves. It seemed highly improbable, but the stakes had been rising on this New World Metals operation from the beginning. Riley said, "If you don't know it yet, you are done with Sharps. You are going down for the mistake in Las Vegas. But call him yourself. I'm here to deliver your marching orders." Riley added, "But even though he can't use you anymore, I can." Martell understood, or at least she thought she did. She leaned back now. Gone was any faint concern she had for her well-being, replaced now by anger and indignation. Riley was going to try to recruit her into his scheme, as if she were some sort of cheap agent who would flip at the drop of a hat. He thought he could control her by getting her fired by Sharps, so she'd have no choice but to ally herself with him. Ridiculous. She'd been spied on by the North Koreans. Now Riley was extorting her to join him as an accessory to murder for a rogue regime. That wasn't going to get her back to Paris. No, she wouldn't play ball. She said, "I will contact Duke, and I will demand a face-to-face meeting to explain myself." "You won't get it." "You really think I won't? Let's see. I bet I could get a meeting with him in his wife's bed, if that's what I wanted." She saw the muscles in Riley's jaw tense and then release. His eyes narrowed to slits. He stood and started for the door, and she followed, yelling after him, "You are famous for blaming others for your mistakes, and for letting your ambition cloud your judgment. It happened in Italy, and it led to your downfall." He had reached the door and put his hand on the latch, but he turned back to face her. She continued, "You think the North Koreans would trust you over Sharps? You think Robles will? Sharps isn't in charge of the operation. He is a figurehead. They know that. I am not in charge of the operation either. Blame me for Las Vegas if you must. But whatever happened in Vietnam and New York had nothing to do with me. You are in charge. You will take the fall for that." She smiled now. She saw indecision on his angry face. "I might not keep my job, but you will go down with me, Riley." He squared his body to hers. His breathing deepened, and his eyes widened out of the angry slits. His indecision receded, and he seemed ready to act. "What?" she asked. He took a step closer, and his hands raised toward her face. Veronica thought he was going to pull her to him, to kiss her. She'd seen this look many times in her life. It was always the same. In the throes of an argument came the throes of passion. "This turns you on. You think I want you. Are you insane?" But he didn't pull her close. Instead, he laced his fingers around her feminine throat and tightened his grip. She tried to push away. "What are you?" Her voice left her, replaced by a scream, and then a frightened shriek. Riley threw his body on her, knocked her to the floor. He squeezed with all his might. Her legs kicked and her arms flailed, but he'd positioned himself out of the way of the brunt of the blows. While he choked the life from her, he leaned into her ear, so close her hair tickled his nose. "Silly Veronica. So tight and proper and cold. I told you why I was here. I can still use you. I didn't come to get you to join up with me. I came because I need someone to take the fall. The North Koreans are angry. So somebody has to die." 30 seconds later, she went limp in his hands, but he kept talking to her softly. "This was your mistake. This was Sharps's mistake. But they know me. They appreciate my resolve. They see I'm not like Sharps." He recognized she was dead now, so he let go slowly and lowered her head onto the hardwood floor. He rose. "I'm a man who gets things done." Chapter 56. Adil Zarif woke at first light, rolled out his prayer rug, and knelt facing Mecca. He said his prayers and then sat around waiting for Emilio to wake up. When the young Mexican finally did stir, it was another 20 minutes before he rose and knocked on the door to Zarif's room. They ate breakfast in silence and then watched some television. By 10 a.m., a local news station was already covering the impending arrival of Jack Ryan. Zarif could not understand the reporter, but he watched the pictures of the National Palace and the airport, and Emilio did his best to provide running translations. From the reporter, Zarif learned several things he already knew, like the time the president would arrive and his planned agenda for the official visit. Zarif also heard talk of a lot of things that he knew were never going to happen. No matter how much the reporter gushed about the spread of the meal that would be served tonight, there would not be a dinner thrown in Jack Ryan's honor. And no matter how big and beautiful the Plaza de la Constitución was, Ryan was not going to go on a walking tour with the Mexican president there, because he would die before he got there. But the Iranian did pick up one interesting tidbit. This was the first Zarif had heard that the First Lady of the United States was not accompanying her husband today, but would instead fly down the next afternoon. The woman was apparently some sort of a doctor. Emilio didn't hear what sort, and according to the pieces Emilio translated into English that Zarif understood, she had important work to do in Maryland and would come down when she was finished. Zarif told himself this woman would not be working all day today and tomorrow as she had planned. When she learned that her husband had been blown to 1,000 pieces, she would probably never work again. At 11 a.m., the two men were picked up by two more Maldonado operators from Guerrero who didn't know the city as well as they should, and they made a few wrong turns on their way to their destination. Emilio yelled at them from the back, and the men yelled at him. Zarif was unnerved by the two men's disheveled appearance and their utter lack of knowledge of the city, and he worried his entire plan to make a new life for himself in the safety of North Korea could be derailed by these uncouth cowboys getting pulled over by a cop on the way to the assassination. Zarif had nothing on his person that would incriminate him. He just carried his mobile phone, the long-range cordless phone he'd used to trigger the bomb, and the rechargeable batteries that went into it, which he kept outside the unit so that it did not accidentally send a signal and detonate the bomb too early. But he knew he might get questioned by the police if these fools drew attention to themselves, and the police would quickly find he was foreign and detain him. Despite Zarif's concern, they made it to their destination without incident. At the scene, crowd control barriers had already been erected, and at the street market on José J. Herrera, enough of a crowd had formed close to the barricades that Zarif decided he didn't want to get any closer. The police were already in place at the barricades, and although the Iranian didn't think he looked much different from the Mexicans around here, he was dark-complexioned, and he wore a dark beard and mustache. He did not want to put this belief to the test and ruin his chance at a comfortable retirement on a beach full of beautiful Asian girls. So Adil Zarif and Emilio stayed back and out of sight, but this was no threat to their plan, because they did not have to get any closer to detonate the bomb. Another Maldonado man, Emilio said his name was Gordo, was already positioned across the street, close to the barricades at the other side of the intersection. He had a near-perfect position and line of sight on several blocks of Vidal Alcocer, because there was a large parking lot to the north that gave him unobstructed views. He also had an iPad with which he would film the arrival of the presidential motorcade and transmit it instantly to Emilio's iPhone. Once the two presidential limousines were in front of the stone facade of the parking garage, Zarif would call the phone attached to the IED. Gordo was going to die in the blast. Zarif had calculated this fact the second he saw the image on Emilio's phone, but he said nothing to Emilio. While they were strolling around the market killing time, Emilio said, "The others will wait for the explosion to attack." Zarif did not understand. He cocked his head to the side. "What others?" 12 men from Guerrero are taking part in the attack. They are waiting in the area. They all have cuernos de chivo." "What is that?" Emilio thought for a moment. "Goat horns." The Iranians still had no idea what the Mexican was talking about. "You know, AK-47s. A couple of guys have RPGs, too. Once the bomb goes off, they will come out of the crowd and start shooting." Emilio grinned. "It's gonna be crazy." Zarif was furious. "No one told me about this." "Relax. It is good. They will make sure Ryan is dead." "No, they won't. They will be seen in the crowd before the president comes, and someone will warn the Americans." Emilio tried to wave away the comment, but Zarif demanded to speak to the Maldonado cell leader. After a few minutes more trying to allay Zarif's fears, Emilio finally dialed a number on his mobile phone and spoke to the man on the other end for a minute. Finally, after a conversation translated by Emilio, Zarif persuaded the cell leader to have the Maldonado men back out of the crowd and move one block east of the motorcade route. He explained that once the explosion rocked the street, they could run one block and shoot up the scene to their heart's content. The cell leader put his men in four pickup trucks and parked them on Nicolas Bravo, with orders to wait for the big bang and then race to the scene. Two trucks would hit the motorcade from the southeast on José J. Herrera, and two more from the northeast on Nacional. Zarif felt like these men were going to race up to the site where Jack Ryan already lay dead, and then do nothing more than get themselves massacred by the 100 or so cops and Secret Service agents who were still alive. But that wasn't his problem. He felt better now that there would be no tip-offs to the coming event, so he and Emilio stepped into a Starbucks, ordered iced coffees, and sat down to watch the video feed on his phone. The Iranian had command-detonated devices by watching video cameras, but he was pretty sure this was the first time anyone had assassinated a world leader via iPhone. Chapter 57. Air Force One touched down at 12:05 p.m. The pilot brought the aircraft to a predetermined point on the tarmac, and then the mobile stairs were driven up. Quickly, a red carpet was rolled out, and members of a 40-man honor guard took their positions on either side. Bomb squad personnel, K-9 teams, counter-assault SWAT officers, and hundreds of other American security forces representing a half-dozen federal agencies were already at the airport. They'd arrived more than a week earlier with the advance team, or else on one of the four C-141 cargo aircraft full of men and equipment that had landed the day before. Dozens of Secret Service agents fanned out around the aircraft, among them lead advance agent Dale Herbers, who took a position watching the expanse of Benito Juarez International's tarmac, along with the rest of the team. His advance work was now complete, and normally he would be moving on to his next location immediately, but the security needs here in Mexico required him to stay for POTUS's arrival and motorcade to the Palacio Nacional, and then his hotel. 12 minutes after landing, lead protection agent Andrea Price O'Day exited the aircraft and walked down the stairs. She took up a position at the foot of the stairs, and seconds later, President of the United States Jack Ryan emerged from Air Force One and headed down himself. There was no music for him. This was not an official state visit, but rather an official visit, which was one step down and less full of pomp and circumstance. Still, Ryan was greeted at the bottom of the stairs by the Mexican foreign minister and a few other high-level functionaries, and while he stood there talking, mostly through an interpreter, U.S. Ambassador to Mexico Horatio Stiles quietly came out of the airplane and descended. He followed the president in the receiving line, and then headed for the limo with Ryan and O'Day. The beasts were parked back to front, and small flags of Mexico hung from poles on the fenders. It was de rigueur on foreign trips to display the local flag on the president's vehicle as a show of respect. The limo in front was positioned just beyond the honor guard, and the back door to the rear limo was lined up perfectly with the red carpet, and the door was open. O'Day stood at the door while Ryan folded his 6-foot frame into the vehicle, and after Ambassador Stiles entered the back of the big black limo, she shut the door and ordered her team to the cars. O'Day got in the front passenger side of Ryan's limo, next to driver Mitchell Delaney. Two agents rode on the running boards of the vehicle as it rolled forward in the motorcade, but they would hop off and get into a chase car at the airport's exit. In front of the presidential limo was the other beast, and in front of that a dozen black Chevy Suburbans carrying Secret Service, White House, and Department of State personnel. Ahead of these were Mexican police cars, some dozen in all, and at the very front of the convoy, 21 Mexican Federal Police motorcycles rumbled through the intersections, all of which had already been blocked off with more police. Behind the president's vehicle came two Suburbans ferrying close protection agents, then three specially outfitted Suburbans carrying the counter-assault team. These vehicles all had open back gates full of armed men scanning both sides of the road, and they had hatches on the roof they could use to stand and fire from above. A fourth counter-assault vehicle carried more heavy weapons and security equipment for the SWAT officers. After this main security contingent came the Roadrunner, the unofficial name given to the Mobile Command and Control Vehicle, a Suburban filled with high-tech communications equipment that allowed the president and his team secure comms even while driving in foreign countries. After the Roadrunner were two white 16-passenger media vans, then another 12 SUVs and sedans carrying more VIPs. All of these vehicles were already full, as the press and other staff traveling with the president had deplaned before the president. The U.S. contingent of the motorcade was 35 vehicles, but the Mexicans added more than 80, most in the form of uniformed federal police on motorcycles. In the lead media van, 16 reporters from print, television, and wire services sat crammed together. In the middle of the first row behind the driver, 27-year-old CNN reporter Jill Crosby checked the service on her mobile phone. She was new to international travel, and although she'd been told she'd have no more trouble getting a signal in Mexico City than she would at the Washington Bureau where she worked, she needed to confirm it for herself. She breathed a sigh of relief when her phone displayed 4 bars, a full-strength signal. She'd never traveled with the president before, and she had no plans to call anyone other than her boyfriend this afternoon, but she wanted to be ready for anything. That was her mantra, and it had gotten her this far. After all, you didn't make it this high in CNN at such a young age, assigned to an international flight aboard Air Force One, without working your ass off and leaving nothing to chance. In the back seat of the beast, Ryan and Stiles drank bottled water and discussed protocol, but only for a short time, because the president wanted to hear another of the ambassador's old war stories. The Marine had been in Grenada and in Panama, and he'd finished his military career fighting in the Middle East. He wasn't one to offer up long tales about past action, especially not to the president, who had his own fascinating history that was somewhat longer than the younger ambassador's. But Ryan had been a Marine himself, and he peppered Stiles with questions about his time in the service, like a fascinated college student. It was 2:18 a.m. in Pyongyang, North Korea, but General Ri Tae-jin wore his full uniform, and he sat at his desk in his office in the Reconnaissance General Bureau. Across the room was a 32-inch CRT television tuned to the American television news station CNN. With the general in his office was a female translator, herself in the green uniform of the Chosun Imingun, the Korean military. She had been ordered here with no explanation of why she was to sit with the general throughout the early morning and provide running translations of U.S. television news. Right now, the station was running its noon news hour, a story about flooding along the Ohio River. The translator gave the information to Ri quickly and confidently, but other than to verify her ability as a translator, the general wasn't interested. His mind was racing now, thinking about the importance of the next few minutes. He had entered into this operation with doubt and anger, but as the scheme had progressed, as the pieces fell into place with the finding of the assassin in Syria, and as he'd heard reports back from his agents in Mexico City who were secretly monitoring the actions of the Maldonado cartel, he began to become cautiously optimistic about the entire enterprise. And when the American president stole the mineral refinery equipment 2 days earlier, indicating to all he knew Ri's operation to build the processing plant directly correlated with the operation to obtain ICBM technology, General Ri knew Fire Axe, his operation in Mexico City, had to succeed for his operation in Cheongju to succeed. As if by curse or by fortune, one scheme folded into the other. For Ri to live, Ryan had to die. He held a hand in the air, stopping the translator's work in mid-sentence. Ohio could drown or wash away. Ri could not care less. You may pause until the important news comes on the air. The translator swallowed uncomfortably. Apologies, Comrade General. How will I know what is important? Ri's sad eyes blinked and brightened, and his nearly perpetual frown curved upward. You will know. As the beast made a left off Costa Rica onto Vidal Alcocer, Ryan waved to a small crowd behind a barricade. Most seemed happy to see him, but a few angry-looking people, young males and females, waved a banner that he was not able to read. Ryan turned to Stiles. I bet the Maldonado killing in Acapulco gave you a few headaches. Stiles said, Speaking as ambassador to Mexico, I confess it was a difficult time diplomatically, at least in our dealing with the general public, since the Maldonado brothers did enjoy some popular support around portions of the western regions of the country. Ryan nodded. But if I might be allowed to speak as a Marine for a moment? Please do. That son of a bitch needed to go. Jack nodded again. Stiles leaned forward. I understand totally if you are not at liberty to say, Mr. President, but I sure would be curious to know if we, in fact, had operators on the ground in Acapulco. With a dry look, Ryan replied, Can neither confirm nor deny, Ambassador. And then he finished the line with a little wink. Stiles turned to look out the window. You just made my day, Mr. President. 4 blocks away, 2 men, one Mexican and in his 20s, the other Iranian and in his 40s, sat at a small round table in the back corner of a Starbucks, both men leaning over a mobile phone. The older man held a white cordless telephone in his hand, but it was hidden under the table, resting on the backpack between his feet. Anyone paying attention might notice both men were perspiring, but the other patrons of the shop were engrossed in their own conversations and work. Adil Zarif watched the video feed intently, hesitant to blink lest he miss the first limousine. Gordo moved the camera around more than Zarif would have liked, and the image shook and jerked as the crowd around the man at the barricade jostled him to get their own cameras up and into position. But Zarif thought it was a gift from Allah that the image on Emilio's little phone settled down and centered perfectly, just as a black Suburban passed in front of the wall, and the first big black limousine passed, its Mexican hood flags whipping in the breeze. At the back of the Starbucks, Adil Zarif muttered softly to himself, Allahu Akbar. At the same moment, his table mate, the Maldonado man Emilio, simply said, Come mierda. Eat shit. Zarif pressed the button on the phone and connected the call. Even here in the Starbucks, more than 3 blocks away, the explosion was deafening. Chapter 58. A dark gray cloud covered everyone and everything. The entire street, the side streets around, the edge of the street market on the west, and the open parking lot on the east, everything in a 25-yard radius from the blast site was completely obscured by smoke and dust and tiny airborne particles of concrete. Many outside the impenetrable cloud for another 25 yards in all directions were dead or dazed or disoriented by the force of the blast. Eardrums were stunned and ringing. Equilibrium was disrupted by the concussion. Another 25 yards in all directions was consumed by wrecked vehicles or other confusion. Shrapnel this far out still caused death. Windows were shattered. Car alarms blared. No one screamed for several seconds, the confusion and disbelief overpowering the natural sensation of fear. Secret Service agent Dale Herbers was one of 5 men in a Suburban 6 vehicles ahead of Swordsman. The blast behind them had sent debris raining down on the roof of his SUV, but the driver looked back in his rear view and prepared to stomp on the gas. If they were under attack, the first rule was to get POTUS out of the engagement area as quickly as possible. But the sheer size of the rolling cloud of destruction behind him caused him to doubt standard protocol. Would the beast even be able to roll out of the kill zone? The driver called into his mic, trying to find out what he needed to do, but he did this simultaneously along with 30 other agents, and his transmission was walked over. Herbers was the lead agent in the vehicle, so in the absence of any other instruction, he knew he'd need to lead the 4 men with him. He realized from the size of the blast that his vehicle might possibly be the closest to the president that had not been destroyed. But there was no way he was going to order his driver to back into the cloud to go looking for Swordsman, because for all he knew, the president was lying injured in the street. Instead, Herbers made a brave call. Pull over to open the lane, then everyone bail, cover, and evacuate. The driver raced the vehicle to the side of the 6-lane road, giving as much open space as possible for any cars behind to continue on if they were able. The 5 agents then unloaded quickly, drawing their Sig Sauer pistols as they did so. This action put them in danger, of course, but there was no way they were continuing on without knowing if the beast was operable or even intact. And all Secret Service agents knew their primary job was to cover and evacuate the principal, so Herbers and the others began sprinting toward the massive gray cloud. Almost instantly, Herbers saw his call to pull to the side of the road was folly. Nothing was going to be rolling to the south on Vidal Alcocer. They passed wrecked Suburbans, lying on their sides or perpendicular to the traffic lanes, windshields shattered, tires ripped apart and smoking. These SUVs weren't moving without a 12 men pushing them out of the way, and there was no time to stop for that until Swordsman was safe. Here and there a few men had climbed out of the damaged vehicles, but Herbers also saw bodies in the road and slumped over steering wheels. On his right, a crowd that had gathered behind the barricades on José J. Herrera looked like a massive tangle of prostrate bodies. Herbers slowed here to train his gun on any potential threats, but the only movement he saw was a little writhing and staggering by a few survivors in the midst of the stillness of death in the crowd. A voice came through his earpiece, shouting something that seemed like it was a warning, but right now it seemed as if 100 car alarms blared in a 6 different sing-song keys, each bleat trying to shout over the other, and Herbers couldn't make out the call. He saw no threats, so he turned away from the crowd and continued on toward the last known location of the beast, running flat out in his dress shoes and business suit. His earpiece mic was alive now with calls, but he hadn't heard a word from O'Day, the president's lead agent. Just as he reached the edge of the thick cloud of smoke and ran into it, he heard pounding gunfire behind him. Even before he turned around, he recognized the weapon from its distinctive sound. It was an AK-47, a rifle carried by no one in the Secret Service or in the Mexican Federal Forces. He shouted into his wrist mic at the same time as dozens of other men and women, "Contact!" Instantly, he heard the high-pitched snapping of bullets flying past him in the street, coming from the direction of the crowd. In the back of the smoke cloud, an entire city block from where Herbers now stood in the street hunting for the source of the gunfire, Secret Service men who were still alive stumbled from their vehicles and began moving toward the cloud. They had no choice but to dismount, because burning vehicles in front of them blocked the way. The Roadrunner was down and on its side. No one had climbed out of it yet, though it had been a full 30 seconds since the massive blast. The members of the counterassault team who had not died in the explosion or were not now wrapped up and disoriented in the dark cloud raced forward with their M4 rifles, desperate for any information, either through their eyes or through their headsets. In the smoke, guns swung around in all directions looking for targets, and men reached out in vain, trying to find anyone or anything close by to help orient them. Suddenly, seconds after the sound of AK fire south of their position sent the men scrambling, more gunfire erupted from the north, behind them. It was more automatic AKs along with staccato snaps from handguns as Secret Service agents returned fire. The counter-assault men at the northern edge of the cloud turned to engage two pickup trucks approaching from a side street, but the smoke and dust behind them enveloped them as the cloud grew. Over the sound of the new multidirectional gunfire, a single screamed report filled every earpiece, headset, and vehicle radio of the massive Secret Service contingent. RPG! Jack Ryan opened his eyes and blinked away what he thought were tears. He brought his hand to his face and rubbed it, and he noticed his glasses were gone. He pulled his hand back and saw he was bleeding from his head. He was wholly unaware there had been an explosion. He saw no flash. He heard no loud noise. He wondered if they had been in some sort of traffic accident. Right now, he was only aware that he lay awkwardly on his right side, his legs higher than his head. Ambassador Stiles's body was crumpled next to him. There was little light, which was odd, because the last thing he remembered from before he blacked out was that it had been a beautifully sunny afternoon. The beast was upside down. This became clear after a few seconds more, but even through the vehicle windows all he saw was a deep gray, as if they had somehow crashed into a dark lake. That couldn't be. He wondered if he was dazed, so he shook his head to clear it, and only then did he feel the dull but pervasive pain on his right side. "Mr. President." "Yes, Andrea. I'm okay." He wasn't okay, but he was alive, and Andrea Price O'Day was in the front seat, herself upside down. She needed to hear his voice, so he complied. Now Ryan reached forward and put his hand on the back of Horatio Stiles. He was lying almost flat on the limo's ceiling, and he wasn't moving. Ryan meant to give him a shake to wake him up, but when he did so, the man's head lolled to the side, facing Ryan's. His eyes were open, and his pupils rolled back. Ryan could see his neck was broken. "Stiles is dead," he called to O'Day. But she was transmitting on her mic, and she did not respond. Ryan heard gunfire outside the limo now, and it sounded like it was coming from two directions. A larger explosion, this sounded like an RPG hitting a vehicle, came from close behind. O'Day said, "We're staying in the vehicle. We've got oxygen and armor, and as long as we..." She stopped talking. Jack rolled himself onto his left side now, and then onto his knees. He felt like his right arm was not cooperating, but it was there, still in his suit and not gushing blood, so he wasn't sure what his problem was. He looked up to Andrea, and then he saw why she stopped talking. Smoke began filling the interior of the car. She turned to him. "Listen carefully. Stay where you are. I'm coming around to your door." She didn't wait for Ryan to respond. Instead, she kicked open her front passenger door, rolled out onto the ground. Ryan called out to the driver now. "Hey, Mitch, you okay? We've got to go." The man hung upside down from his seatbelt. He turned his head toward Ryan, but he did not reply. Andrea appeared at Ryan's window. She yanked hard on the upside-down door, and it opened with a creak. Ryan rolled out onto the street now. He was surprised to find the limo had been thrown all the way to the curb, probably 20 feet from where it had been in the middle of the road. Ryan coughed out the smoke he had inhaled inside the vehicle, and then he began to stand. O'Day shielded him against the side of the limo, kept him on his knees, and he looked around for the first time. Two men in the tactical gear of the counter-assault team came running through the thick smoke, their weapons high and their laser targeters cutting through the cloud like lightsabers. They formed on Ryan, and they too made a cordon around him and tried in vain to scan for targets in the massive amount of smoke and dust. A third special agent, this one in a suit and tie, appeared. His face and leg were covered with blood, but he was ambulatory, and he opened the driver's side door of the upturned limo to help Special Agent Mitch Delaney out. But Ryan saw the man was heavily disoriented from the impact of the flipping limo. O'Day was calling for a vehicle, any vehicle to make its way slowly into the blast zone, through the half-dozen or so burning pieces of wreckage, and up to the beast. She had to evacuate Swordsman, preferably in something armored, but at this point she'd settle for anything with four wheels and a motor. Ryan tried to pull out Ambassador Stiles, but the agents around him kept him covered tightly. The smoke was obscuring their view of the attack that was taking place from two compass points, and this added to the confusion, but it was also obscuring the attackers' view of the blast area, so they couldn't possibly know the president was more or less out in the open, kneeling at the curb. And then, from the south, came a racing, hissing sound that approached through the smoke. No one saw it, and no one identified it in time to do little more than crouch. The RPG hit the side of the limousine and exploded, throwing everyone around it to the ground. The 216-passenger media vans had been well behind the explosion, but still the shockwave shook the vehicles on their chassis, and debris pounded them and cracked the windshields in several places. The windows along the passenger sides were shattered when the rearview mirrors were struck by flying debris and went flying into the sides of the vans. The incredible sound of the detonation and the subsequent impacts of shrapnel and car parts sent the passengers covering their heads and scrambling to get low. The driver of the lead van was a member of the White House press office and not a trained security agent, but he'd been told what to do in an emergency. He was to get off the road, out of the way of security forces ahead of his van if the decision was made to retrograde out of the area, or of those behind the van if they needed to come up and assist. 10 seconds after the explosion, however, he had not moved at all. Both of the van's front tires had been eviscerated by high-explosive shrapnel from the rear artillery shell that had torn across the road. 4 media personnel in the first van had been cut by broken glass, and more were disoriented by shock, but CNN press pool reporter Jill Crosby was unhurt. She was sitting in the second row of seats, just to the left of Fox reporter Jeff Harks. Harks caught a face full of glass, and while he grabbed at a vicious wound just over his right ear, Crosby climbed over his legs, grabbed the door latch, and flung it open. While others in the vehicle either tended to one another's injuries or tried to get out of the van, Jill Crosby ran toward the smoke-obscured scene ahead. She'd just pulled her phone out of her pocket and dialed into CNN's Atlanta headquarters when the gunfire started. She arrived at a damaged Suburban that had been knocked 90 degrees and now faced west on the north-south thoroughfare. She ducked low and ran past the SUV, and on the other side of this she saw an identical Suburban fully engulfed in flames. An explosion erupted near her, knocking her to the ground. She did not recognize that she had almost been blown apart by an RPG, so she climbed back to her feet and ran forward. All around her now, there was more and more shooting. She entered the thick wall of gray smoke just as her producer answered on the other end.
"It's Crosby! The presidential motorcade is under attack! We've got to go live!"
Two counter-assault team officers raced past her with their guns at their shoulders, and then they disappeared into the smoke in front of her. Herbers had given up on getting to the president. His job now was to suppress the hostiles in the two pickup trucks on the southern side of the engagement zone. The vehicles had pulled right into the crowd of dead and wounded. Herbers lay flat in the street and engaged the driver of one of the white pickups as the man shot his AK while crouched behind his car door, incorrectly thinking it to be suitable cover. Herbers and another agent dumped round after round of 40-caliber ammo through the thin sheet metal, killing the man. He'd heard the transmission from O'Day saying she had swordsmen at the Beast, but the Beast was down. She'd called to the second limo to have it come to her, but Herbers had yet to hear a response. He didn't allow himself an instant to think about what had gone wrong. That would come later, much later, and it would come only for those who managed to survive the firefight. So he emptied his magazine at the threats on the side street, reloaded, and racked his pistol slide to engage some more. Just as he brought it back up on target, he saw a flash of light in the shade on the far side of Jose J. Herrera. Instantly the flash grew in size, and he realized he was looking at a streaking rocket-propelled grenade. It raced 5 feet off the ground, shot directly over his head as it passed into the smoke behind him, and then he heard the impact of an explosion. He hoped like hell the RPG hadn't just hit Swordsman's damaged limo, with the President of the United States standing next to it. Herbers opened fire at the source of the launch, a man standing alone with an empty rocket tube, sending the man to cover. Then he started looking around for a vehicle. He knew the president couldn't wait around in the kill zone any longer. A Suburban with a broken windshield was upright on good tires in the road, just 50 feet away. He saw a Secret Service agent slumped over the wheel, and another man lying face down outside an open rear driver's side door. Herbers leapt to his feet and started running for the black SUV. Chapter 59. Ryan climbed back to his knees for the second time in the past 45 seconds. His right arm hung by his side. The pain grew by the second, but through the pain he saw Andrea lying face up on the curb, blood running from her forehead. He blinked away the grit that had made its way into his eyes and crawled to her. She was just 5 feet away, but it felt like a mile. All around him men fired weapons. Alarms shrieked. A helicopter had flown so low that it whipped the smoke away in swirling vortexes. Two agents kept their hands on Ryan's back as they kept their weapons sweeping, occasionally firing, and hot brass clanged on the street. Ryan cradled Andrea's head in his hands. Her eyes were closed, and her mouth was parted slightly. He put his head to her mouth, and then to her chest, and he felt and heard nothing. She wasn't breathing. A counter-assault officer tried to pull Ryan to his feet now, to bring him back to the relative safety of the upturned vehicle, but Ryan swatted the man's grip away with his left arm. Then he pinched Andrea's nose shut and began rescue breathing. He'd been trained decades ago, but his wife had given him a refresher when Kyle was born, so he knew the fundamentals. He pushed away the chattering gunfire, and even a third detonation of an RPG against the wall of a parking garage nearby, and he continued short, powerful breaths into her mouth, followed by one-handed chest compressions. He was on his third round of breathing when he saw a response from her, just a quick inhalation and an expression of discomfort on her face, but he knew she was alive. He was about to talk to her when a black Suburban raced backward down the sidewalk and screeched to a stop just 10 feet away. Now several CAT officers pulled Ryan away from Andrea Price O'Day. "Wait!" he shouted, but President Ryan was not in charge. "We'll take care of her!" a young agent shouted, pulling the president toward the vehicle. The back door opened and Ryan was pushed in roughly, while men with body armor surrounded him on all sides. He tried to get a look back over his shoulder at his longtime friend lying motionless in the street, but one of his protection detail was there, almost on top of him, and he shoved Ryan all the way to the floorboard and covered him with his own body. Ryan screamed in pain. The agent behind the wheel yelled to the other men, "There's gunmen and wreckage ahead! Can we go back?" The two counter-assault men had come from behind in the motorcade.
"Affirmative! Wreckage on the road for 50 yards, then you are clear!"
Another man shouted,
"Punch it!"
The vehicle shot backward. The driver, Special Agent Herbers, looking over his shoulder as he drove in reverse, doing his best to avoid slamming into the stationary vehicles. While he drove, another agent shouted into his headset. Special Agent Davis Linklater broadcast on the Secret Service net.
"Swordsman is mobile. Heading north. Everybody get out of the way and then fall in."
He looked up to Herbers behind the wheel. Herbers was in charge here.
"Where are we going?"
Herbers didn't take his eyes off the road behind him.
"Airport."
The Suburban sideswiped a burning counter-assault vehicle lying on its side, jolting all in the SUV, but it kept moving backward at speed. Everyone in the Starbucks 3 blocks away had either run outside to see the scene at the far end of the street market, or else pushed themselves up to the window glass to look outside. With two exceptions. Emilio and Zarif walked out onto José J. Herrera and turned left, away from the blast, although the young Mexican walked backward, marveling at the massive cloud of smoke.
"Dios mío," he mumbled in awe.
Zarif didn't know what the kid expected, but it clearly wasn't anything like what had just happened. He turned back to Zarif and picked up his pace.
"My God, that was big, man."
Zarif didn't hear any shooting until they had walked another half block, but when the crackling gunfire came, he was pleasantly surprised. He knew the sound of an AK, and he heard multiple Kalashnikovs open up. Their machine-like cyclic thumping mixed nicely with the dozens of car alarms and the thundering of helicopters overhead. A scene of utter chaos had erupted, and that was even before the first crash of an RPG explosion. Both men were picked up in the truck by the two Maldonado cowboys who had dropped them off over an hour earlier, and they began driving back to the safe house to the north. Secret Service Agent Davis Linklater straddled the President of the United States in the back seat of the Suburban. He ran his hands all over Ryan's body, under his coat, and along his back. Ryan winced when Linklater felt his right shoulder, and the seasoned special agent saw the President's pupils lose focus.
"Where do you hurt, Mr. President?"
Ryan looked around him, and turning his head caused a blinding pain in his right shoulder.
"Yeah,"
he responded.
"Where, sir?"
Ryan looked down at his left wrist. It was swollen.
"My wrist."
After a moment, he said,
"I think I broke my shoulder, too."
Linklater felt a little more, this time closer to Ryan's clavicle. Ryan cried out,
"Damn it, Link!"
"Collarbone," Linklater said. Ryan nodded distractedly.
"Andrea. How's Andrea?"
The agent replied, "I honestly don't know, Mr. President. We're going to take care of you, get you to the aircraft, and get home."
"We can't leave Andrea and—"
"There are hundreds of law enforcement and first responders back at the scene. They will take good care of her, I promise."
"I want you to find out."
"I will.
When we are on board Air Force One."
Lead Secret Service Agent Dale Herbers was behind the wheel, and he was damn glad he'd been here in town for a week already. He knew his way back to the airport without even having to look at the GPS, and this was good, because the GPS had been knocked off the windshield and was now nowhere to be found. He was well off the motorcade route, trying to skirt around the heavy traffic that had been created when the route was reopened to traffic after the motorcade had passed. He raced through intersections at high speed, honking his horn. This vehicle wasn't armored, but it did have strobing blue lights, and he ran them continuously as he drove. Herbers made a hard right to move parallel to gridlocked Eje 2 Norte Transvaal, and immediately he heard about it from Linkletter.
Smooth, Dale. He's got fractures. Unknown internal.
Okay. There were 4 armed men in the car in total. Herbers, 2 shooters from the counter-assault team, and Davis Linkletter, one of Swordsman's protection detail. When they left the ambush site, Linkletter and the 2 shooters had been in back with the president, but one of the CAT agents had climbed up into the front passenger seat, kicking all the other agents in the head with his shiny black combat boots in the process. Now he rode shotgun with his assault rifle over the dashboard, scanning left and right. And in the back, the other black-clad agent with a carbine was on his knees next to Linkletter and Swordsman, facing the rear window and watching for any threats on their tail. While Linkletter attended to Swordsman, Dale Herbers found himself running comms as well as driving, which wasn't optimal at all, but he wanted the shooters in the car concentrating on watching for threats. Herbers had called out his location to the rest of the detail, and by now mobile Secret Service agents were racing to catch up with him from behind, fortifying the protective bubble around Air Force One, or else in vehicles heading out of the airport to meet the Suburban along the way. Over a dozen Mexican Federal Police motorcycles had managed to keep up with the black Suburban as it left the blast zone, and 2 more Suburbans full of special agents were a few hundred yards back and blasting through lights and stop signs to stay with the evac. In the back seat, Linkletter had finished his initial assessment of his protectee, and he called it into the aircraft so Ryan's personal doctor, Mora Handworker, would be ready for him when he arrived. When Linkletter finished with his transmission, Ryan reached out and grabbed the lapel of his suit coat. "How many dead, Davis?"
"I don't know, sir."
He shook his head.
"A lot." "Tell me what you saw."
"I was in the chase car 2 back from you. It was an IED. The SUV in front of me was down. I didn't see anyone bail. I saw Ambassador Stiles. He appeared deceased. The driver of your vehicle, he was deceased."
Jack shut his eyes.
"Delaney." Mitch Delaney had been on his detail for 2 years. He'd been alive when Ryan saw him, but that was before the RPG struck the beast.
"Yes, sir."
"What else did you see?"
"Cat came up and wasted a bunch of fuckers. Sorry, sir, just a little adrenaline."
"It's okay, Davis," Ryan said as he patted the man's lapel back in place. "Whoever they were most definitely fuckers."
Chapter 60 Jill Crosby had spent the past minute and a half lying flat on the ground next to the mobile command and control vehicle that everyone called the Roadrunner. A fierce gun battle raged all around her. She'd been on the other side of the vehicle when the Suburban raced backward along the sidewalk to the upturned limousine and then continued backward behind her, so she'd seen none of that. But even if she had not been shielded from the SUV, she still might have missed it, because her eyes were fixed firmly on the wreckage just 75 feet away. It was the beast. It was split in half and burning, and smoldering charred bodies sat in the back seat. This was Crosby's first time in the presidential motorcade, and she had no idea there were actually 2 identical limousines. She was certain the vehicle in front of her was the one the president had been traveling in. The gunfire and explosions abated after 2 minutes, and almost immediately after that she saw Secret Service men in dark suits and sunglasses race to the burning limo in the middle of the road and begin spraying it with fire extinguishers. Other CAT men appeared and covered them, unsure if there were any more threats in the buildings. The fact there was such an effort to put out the fire convinced her of what was going on. She had no doubt in her mind she was looking at the bodies of U.S. Ambassador Horatio Stiles and President of the United States, Jack Ryan. She filmed it all with her camera phone, but when she heard a voice on the phone's speaker, she quickly brought it back to her mouth, ending the shot. She'd wanted to send a live video feed from her phone to be broadcast, but the producer told her to just record for playback so they could control what made it on the air. The anchor in Atlanta set up the phone call quickly on live TV.
CNN's Jill Crosby is on the phone with us from the scene in Mexico City where the presidential motorcade has just come under attack. Jill, are you there?
I'm here, Don. I'm in the center of a continuing, protracted ambush of the presidential motorcade. There was a bomb or a missile, some sort of massive explosion, and that was followed quickly by more shooting and smaller explosions. The motorcade stopped moving, so I left the press pool van to try and get through the smoke to see the president. I saw wreckage and bodies, and then I had to take cover where I am right now.
Are you able to see the president? She filmed again for a moment, then brought the phone back to her mouth. The sounds of sirens, shouting and screaming, and the low-flying helicopters meant she had to yell.
The limousine is on fire. There are two bodies in the back of the limousine that I can see. At least one in the front.
Let's be very careful. Are you certain the president was in that limousine? Jill didn't understand the question. Where else would the president be but in the limo? She answered authoritatively.
I saw Ryan and Ambassador Stiles get into this vehicle. I believe I am filming their bodies right now, Don.
The anchor in Atlanta cautioned the audience that there had been no confirmation, and reports from the scene were apt to change quickly. But it didn't matter. Within 3 minutes and 12 seconds of the IED's detonation on the corner of Vidal Alcocer and José J. Herrera, a reporter on live national television proclaimed that the president had been assassinated. General Ri Tae-jin wanted CNN to show video, but instead he saw an American man with black skin sitting at a desk and talking. He then heard the breathless voice of a woman shouting English above the sounds of sirens, and he listened to his translator's rendition of the woman's words. He nodded over and over as the unconfirmed report came that the attack had been successful. Within seconds, the video came, but it was from a helicopter. The translator said that it was from Mexican television and was being fed into CNN. There was a huge cloud of smoke over a sunny street. In the distant haze, the massive, sprawling city lay out across the bottom of a valley. The camera zoomed to show the burning wreckage of several vehicles, some more cars and SUVs tossed about haphazardly, and rushing first responders moving in every direction. Ri was satisfied. There was a massive zone of destruction. He'd been military intelligence, not infantry, but he had done his share of battle damage assessments, and he noted the zone was much larger than that from the impact of a round of field artillery. No one in the middle of that would survive. Ri felt certain the assassination had been carried out. But there was one more critical component to Operation Fire Axe that he would need confirmation of, so even though it was well after 3 in the morning, he knew neither he nor his translator would be leaving his office for some time to come. The American Secret Service liaison at the airport had told the Mexican federal police official in charge that the vehicle carrying the president would come through the north VIP gate in 5 minutes, and if anyone at the gate tried to stop it, the men in the vehicle would open fire. The Mexican authorities at the airport had the good sense to stay out of the way, but as it happened, lead Special Agent Dale Herbers drove in the middle of a motorcade of 14 vehicles, some containing other members of the Secret Service, but most driven by Mexican police, who were fully involved in the evacuation of the American president. Together they all raced through the gate with sirens and lights blaring, and they all screeched to a halt at the aircraft. Though most of the U.S. security force was still on its way back from the ambush site, there were still more than 25 armed Secret Service men around the plane, and every last one of them had a handgun or a long gun in their hand and their heads on swivels as they checked the area for threats. Linkletter, Herbers, and the two CAT agents helped the president out of the back of the vehicle. Two Air Force Chief Master Sergeants who served as stewards on the aircraft were waiting with a stretcher, but the president walked on his own power to the stairs. He moved hunched over slightly, his right arm hanging and the expression on his face pained, but he was strong enough to make it all the way up to the cabin door of the 747 with only minimal help from the stewards at his side. Ryan was trailed up the stairs by a phalanx of men with assault rifles on their shoulders, all of whom walked backward and trained their holographic weapon sights on the distant terminal or the fields around the airport. Once inside the plane, Ryan reached out to the wall to hold himself up, and his knees gave way. Dr. Mora Handworker was waiting at the entrance, and she caught him. She had already moved many items out of the small but well-equipped medical office right next to the hatch and into the president's suite in the nose of the aircraft just a dozen feet away. Here there was more room for swordsmen to lie down, and more room for Handworker to do everything she needed to do short of X-rays, which, if necessary, could be done in the medical office. Ryan was carried gingerly into his suite and then laid on his back on the bed. His face was ashen from the pain and the mild shock, and blood was smeared from scratches on his forehead. Immediately, Handworker and her nurse for the trip, an Air Force critical care nurse, began cutting off his suit with fabric shears. Arnie Van Damme wasn't along for the trip. Instead, his assistant chief of staff, a fresh-faced 33-year-old named David Detmer, stood far back out of the way of the medical professionals. Still, he was in earshot, so when Ryan started shouting out his name, Detmer leaned his head into the suite.
"I'm here, sir. Secure phone. The vice president has been told. He's on his way back to Washington from California."
Ryan shook his head, causing him a fresh jolt of pain.
"I need Arnie. Then Kathy."
Dr. Handworker glared at Detmer, because she couldn't glare at the president. She did say,
"Mr. President, I need you to lie right here for now and relax. You have a broken collarbone and likely a broken wrist. We'll want to give you an MRI to see if you have a concussion, but that can wait till we're back in D.C. For now, we will go under the assumption that you do have a concussion, so we'll want you to stay flat on your back. We'll immobilize your arm, and this will help with the shoulder pain."
"Okay, but I need to make some calls."
"Sir, first I need to debrief."